Welcome to Talking Paper on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Christian Needon. The theme of this episode is neighbors and their stories. Specifically, I spoke with three of my neighbors who share my apartment building in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, about their take on faraway locales and how they have been inspired by those places. The first part of this episode, I interview Renee Sasha Johansson and Therese Angie Christensen. Both hail from Denmark and share the apartment next to mine. Therese is the founder and CEO of Raw in a Jar, whose marketing tagline is organic and non-toxic skincare that combines ancient beauty traditions and modern dermatology. Renee is a freelance documentary filmmaker whose work has presently taken the couple to Los Angeles, California, where I interviewed them by Skype. I began by asking Therese to talk about her company, as well as what sort of research she did earlier in her life in Denmark that led her to pursue her current line of work.
Well, right now I have a skincare line called Raw in a Jar. So I am the founder of that, and I started it a few years back when I got a rash on my face from this other high-end brand that I was using. And I've actually read a lot of books about like herbs and plants and how you heal yourself and different things like that. So I think my research came out from that, and I remember that I've read that avocado is actually one of the most healing oils that you could put on your skin. So I tried to do that, and I made a little mix of something, and that's how my brand actually started. It came from me studying plants and herbs when I was younger and during my teenage years.
Were you finding that this was something that just wasn't being touched on enough in, say, mainstream beauty publications, that now it's probably being touched on more than it was? Was this something that's relatively new?
I would say it's definitely not in the regular magazines and in fashion. I'd say like once in a while, like the ladies magazines, like such as Elle and Vogue and things like that, would have like a page of clear your skin smoothie or something like that, like something to stay healthy. But I don't think that they really got into, like, you know, you could actually cure yourself with the power of nature, with plants and herbs. That was never, it was always about like clear your skin or how you lose weight or something like that. So I feel like it would have been nice to have that kind of information available, like in fashion magazines as well, like maybe just a little bit. So I guess I've been more into like the nerdy magazines when I was younger. I'm allergic to penicillin. So I've been reading a lot of like magazines from the health store, and it's mainly about like how do you cure like cancer, or how do you do this, or how do you, if you drink hot chocolate, you will cure coughing, like things like that, or weird tricks. And you don't really read that in the magazines that's out there, and I feel like that's definitely something that's could be incorporated somehow, you know?
Tell me about what you've seen in terms of the marketplace in Denmark for something like Raw in a Jar compared to the U.S. Are there any differences? Is the clientele that you can go after more ready for something like this than, say, in the U.S.?
What I've been doing with Raw is basically try to make an organic product more trendy and hip. And so I'm trying to get out to as many women as possible by making something that's organic and healthy, but something that's nice and chic you want to have in your bathroom. So I'm trying to make a good mix of that. And I feel like that's not just Europeans, it's also Americans. It's like every woman out there actually always wants something pretty in their bathroom, but they also want to put something natural on their skin. So Raw is in a lot of magazines in Europe. It's becoming really big in Germany and Sweden. And I know that's in a lot of fashion magazines, and it's mainly the high-end fashion magazines. It's not about beauty, actually. It's more like together with like editorials and things like that, and with bloggers or like celebrities using it. So it's a funny mix.
Talking about how to get the word out about it seems like Raw's been written up, as you said, in magazines and bloggers and whatnot. Can you tell me a little bit about your own marketing? Do you pursue print marketing or advertising, or do you go approach different sites to post stuff about Raw there?
We mainly use social media to market Raw in a Jar. It's mainly like Instagram and things like that, Facebook. And what we feel like works the most for us is not paying a PR agency or anything like that. It's actually giving it to influencers and bloggers. And we've been really lucky. We actually had a few European almost celebrities and a Victoria's Secret model. Jasmine Tokes is her name. She used one of the oils and is totally in love. And that's really lucky for us because she actually loves the products and it works for her. So we didn't even force it on her. Like, you know, like that's a lot of brands. They usually do that. They pay celebrities or you could do that. But it just happened very naturally. And I feel very, very lucky that it actually happened organically.
In your own experience, do you respond to advertisements or things that are in a glossy magazine more than things that are in the digital space?
Well, you know what? It's funny because when I want to research something or when I want to look at a trend or get inspiration, I always find it online. But I travel a lot and then I always buy a magazine because usually I don't really buy magazines because honestly, it doesn't really interest me that much. But when I do pick up a magazine and I actually have time to sit there and read it, I go through every page because I have nothing else to do. It does affect me and it does work on me and I find it very inspiring. And there's something about actually turning a page, like a physical page, and I enjoy it. And I actually read more into it versus when I find it online, I tend to scroll through it a lot faster.
So Renee, tell me about what you do for a living and what you read as a youth that might have influenced you going in that direction.
Yeah, cool. I'm a film director. I mainly do documentary films, a lot of branded content these days, and I've done a ton of TV and like longer format documentary films back in the day. Right now I'm working on with a Danish artist who seems to be blown up in the US called Lucas Graham. He's nominated now for 3 Grammys, so he's definitely making a name for himself. And part of what I've done for him is a few music videos. And right now, for the last 4 years, I've been recording documentary material on him. And that has been coming out in a short doc series, which is now going to be edited into a feature film. So that's what I'm doing right now. I'm in the pre-production of putting that together. I grew up with a lot of skateboarding and music around me. And I think the magazine, like when I was a kid, that was before the internet. So there was no, like you couldn't just go online and read a lot of stuff. And magazines were actually taking themselves more serious and was way more expensive back then. For me anyway, I didn't have a lot of money growing up. I didn't have money to buy a lot of magazines. So when I got my hands on a trashy magazine, or like there was a few other American magazines like Big Brother and these mags, I would go through every detail of these magazines and just like nerd all out. There was a few good articles in there. It was a lot of it was on skateboarding, but also some on music. We also had a free magazine in Denmark called Gaffa, which is it's still out there and it's actually doing really well. It's I don't know how they can stay free, but they have been for many years. So this was also a go-to magazine for my sake, again because it was free. They actually took music serious. It wasn't like, I think a lot of the magazines back then and also to this day is very just superficial glam bullshit, or they're trying to cater to a bigger audience than just like nerdy musicians or whatever. And back then that's what I wanted, and that was a more like serious, also a little bit more alternative magazines than a lot of the other glam stuff.
As Lucas was going through his rise, were there certain magazines that he was making the cover of where it's like, ah, now he's gotten to this cover, he's gotten to a certain level over in Denmark? Are there certain magazines that for a musician's career over there that you just kind of have to get on to attain a certain level?
I think the scene is so small in Denmark that you don't have a lot of options. There's a magazine called Sound Venue, and then there's Gaffa, which is still out there. That's as far as I know. There could be newer stuff coming up, but again, I haven't lived there for 5 years. But that's as much as I know. And he actually blew up after I moved to the US. But where I saw him and still see him is more in the main media, which is like the bigger newspapers. He's all over the Danish media. He's a big deal in Denmark also. Like one of the bigger newspapers brought out there that the 7 years is actually the biggest hit in Danish history and stuff like that. But they were also the first to take him down once he had a minor crash a few months ago where he just out of exhaustion had to cancel a few shows. And this other, probably the biggest newspaper in Denmark, called him out as, and they never gave him the cover before, and all of a sudden he's on the cover once things are not going very well, just saying that he crashed and he's not able to stand on stage and stuff like that, which wasn't really the deal, you know. He just needed a break because they've had the craziest year.
Let's talk about the beginning of that year. You've been obviously following Lucas and telling his story on video. What was it about him that people glommed onto in the journalism world over there?
They had two just homemade one-take videos out, and that's kind of how people discovered him in Denmark. Drunk in the Morning and Criminal Mind were two like just one-take home videos they did. So that's how a lot of people found them. I found them like super early, and I, by coincidence, I found out I knew his manager, and that's why I contacted them in the first place. And he already had a friend of his was already filming with him, so I kind of have to give up the idea of filming with him. But then I moved to the US, he blew up in Denmark, then Europe, and then about a year or two later they came to the US, and his manager Lasse called me up again and was like, okay, now we're ready and we have money. I'm the only one who's been doing documentary, like close footage of him, along with his friend Jens, who still shoots stills.
Let's talk about the impact of U.S. media or U.S. publications in Denmark. Are there a lot of Danish versions of U.S. print magazines that operate over in Denmark?
Vogue is not there, but Elle magazine is a big magazine in Denmark, and I believe we have Cosmopolitan as well. Elle is the biggest one that's like both in the U.S. and in Denmark. There's like fewer ads in the Danish magazines, but other than that, it's pretty much the same, yeah.
I think you can definitely say that the printed media is struggling these days.
Yeah.
So a lot of the bigger magazines have been dying out over the last few years. Like we had Cover magazine,
yeah.
The version for men died.
Yeah, and I think they're closing that one down as well. So there is a lot of like the mainstream there, yeah. They're closing down. But speaking of that, that's actually where I get mainly my inspiration online. But when I do have like a magazine, let's say my old neighbor, she always had magazines and she would bring it into me like after she was done reading them. So I did always flip through it, and it's just nice to see what's going on, and it's a fast way to like stay, you know, up to date and get the inspiration for where like Raw is going as well, you know? And for like what women want and things like that. So, yeah.
You guys have a really rich collection of magazines in your own place from all over the place. I know they're not in front of you off the top of your head at the moment, but tell me about some of the things that you guys subscribe to or that you guys keep around the house.
Well, I think that's mainly Renee, because a lot of the magazines that I got there is either something that I inherited from my sweet neighbor or something that Raw was in, so I always like to keep the physical copy of it. But it's mainly Danish magazines, and then I also have a few from Vogue and Vanity Fair, and that's pretty much it. And then the artist stuff is Renee.
Yeah, I'm the nerd around that area, I think. There's some magazines that I can't let go. I just find it super inspiring to pick some of these up. How that exactly translates into what I do, I don't exactly know, but it definitely keeps me updated on the few scenes I'm interested in. So that'd be like I've been subscribing on Juxtapost for a while. Lowdown is my all-time favorite. It's a magazine from Berlin.
Yeah.
I believe they have their headquarters, so that it's also quite expensive to buy over here, actually. But Lowdown, I've been following for like 10 plus years. I don't even know how long.
I really like that one, too.
Yeah, they discontinued in Denmark a while back. So after that, I subscribed directly to Germany and had that sent from Germany. And I've continued that moving to the US as well.
But that's like your Bible. You read every word in that one.
I was actually lucky once back in the day when we did, I was so bummed actually because I always wanted to get my stuff in that magazine. And when we did The Red Chapel, a documentary I shot in North Korea back like 10 years ago, and a few years after when it came out for the international market, I think around 2010 or 11, they actually did an article on that, and they had all my shots in there and they didn't credit me. So I was so bummed.
They forget that though sometimes.
Yeah, that happens all the time. I hate when people do that. But I think that the deal is this. What this is actually that the Danish Film Institute bought my shots for promotion purposes, and they probably got all those shots and just printed them in there, and my name wasn't nowhere to be found. So that was a little bit of a bummer, but yeah. I was still happy to see my shots on print and in my favorite magazine.
Yeah, that's...
And with that also comes there's a kind of a Danish equivalent to that called Bitch Lab. This guy, a old friend of mine, Nick Bridge, who's he's actually from New Zealand but moved to Denmark a lot many years ago. If I say that he's heavily inspired by Lowdown and also Monster Children, I don't think he wouldn't say no, because they kind of have like similar. There's something about the language and something about the whole angle and he's actually, they keep it more local, but it's also from all over the place. Again, he's from New Zealand, so he's got some contacts there, and he goes to a lot of the art fairs and stuff like that. And I think it comes out like four times a year by now. And they're doing a really cool job, I think.
Yeah, but and every time they release a magazine, they have a party, and it's so amazing. So and it's made, this magazine is made with so much love. It's it's very personal, and it's so nice.
Yeah, they actually with that, I think it took him a bit by surprise that, just as a side project, as part of Bitch Lab magazine, they did one page in each mag was dedicated to girls, saying girls are awesome, and then a lot of different reasons for why girls are awesome. And they also did a poster, like this banana planted in a donut on a pink background. It might sound a bit dodgy, but it's really nicely done. And I think it totally took him by surprise. How much attention this section got, and now it's—I think it's almost bigger than the actual mag by now. It's
getting, than Bitch Lab, yeah.
Yeah, they're getting a lot of international attention with that, so that's pretty cool.
Oh yeah, Girls Are Awesome is definitely growing.
Yeah,
they made a lot of
So Renee, one other project that you've been involved in over the years that I wanted to mention was Riding Asphalt, both in Denmark and here in the US. Has that been something that's also had images that have appeared in still form in magazines at all?
Yeah, I mean, Asphalt is definitely the most extroverted version of who I am, probably, in some weird way. Because there's been no boundaries to that. Like, it's 100% just my own little perversions, like stories that I wanted to go out and do. And I was lucky that Network A picked it up in the US, and it actually started out as in Denmark in 2008, I think. I did 12 episodes to begin with for the Danish National Broadcast. They opened up a new channel called Pirate TV, and they kind of wanted something streety, skateboardy, that they didn't really know what they wanted. So they asked me to write on something, and I came up with this and made this little series. And later on, I took it to the US. Back then, it was called Asphalt, and now, later, when I'm gonna hopefully continue that someday when I have time again, it's gonna be called Curbside Stories, which I actually think is a more precise title for what it is, because from that you can basically tell, I hope, what it is straight away, you know. Stories from the curb.
What's your reaction when these things are in print, where these motion moments are now still image? Does that change the meaning of them at all for you when you see them in picture form?
I think that's the art of it. Like I once heard the Danish DP Kasper Tuxen say that when he's scouting for a film, or when he walks into a room and he's shooting a scene, he basically always thinks, like, how can I shoot this scene in one shot? So that he's going for this perfect frame that'll kind of tell the whole story in one picture. And I think that was a really good way of thinking about it. Like, ultimately, you can tell the whole story of what you're doing, or at least get a good idea of what the story is about from this one frame you shoot. And I've been shooting a lot of stills as well back in the day, so, like, and still do whenever I have time. But yeah, I think, like, hopefully the like still pictures will translate what the moving stories are about, moving image stories.
And Therese, because of the nature of Raw in a Jar, unlike being clothing where a model would wear it, it's in the hand. In terms of the composition of the photos to promote it, does that change the approach to the kind of composition of a photo when you're marketing this? Is it more attention on the hand because of that's where you want the attention to go?
You know what? It's actually one of my biggest struggles. It's a constant thing that I talk with Renee about, like, how should I do this next campaign or this release of this product? Like, what do you think? It's so boring to have an Instagram or a profile filled with just pack shots or, like, product shots. it's so hard. I'm trying to find girls or people that kind of represent the mood or the universe of the product. It's such a hard one to nail, but I'll never make a campaign where there's a beautiful girl holding a bottle. I can't get myself to do it. So it's always like I either just do a shot of a girl in a very neutral, like, clothing that you can tell, oh, that's Chanel, or that's, because that's not where you want the attention to be on. I'm always trying to make something where you sell like beautiful skin or like a beautiful look, and you want to be this girl, but not because she's wearing lipstick or beautiful hair. It's just because she has this glow or this energy. You can't really tell what it is. And I think that sells it more. So I've been thinking for the last few months how I would do an ad, because we actually considered doing something in Vogue, because British Vogue contacted us and asked if we wanted to do something. And I honestly had no idea. I wanted to make something cool and different, but it's definitely harder to sell than clothes, I think, because clothes you could put on anyone and they could wear it on the street. Like, it's really hard for someone to see, ooh, she has Rana Jar oil on her face. I could totally tell. Like, it's super hard to sell it like that.
I really like the font for Raw. In fact, it's on the front door of your own apartment. Tell me, how long did it take to settle on that and the label? Which I know for a lot of business people, who it takes a long time to settle on the branding, the physical label that they put on their product.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't have any doubt about, like, kind of fonts and kind of look. I was actually really inspired when Renee and I, we moved to New York 5 years ago. We went into like different restaurants, like bars, like old places, and I always got inspired by old bars and alcohol for some reason. Not that I was super drunk, but like the old like bottles, the old medicine cabinets, the very apothecary kind of style. And so I always knew that I wanted something that looked old school, but with a mix of something new and trendy. And then one day I got this idea, if you make different fonts on the label, for some reason it draws your attention more rather than doing just a simple thing. It's nice, but it doesn't draw attention, and it's actually proven. I've read it somewhere, and I'm sorry, I don't know, remember where. So my friend Tatiana, she actually drew the first logo for me. When I put Raw in a Jar, the reason why I called it Raw in a Jar was a quick decision. It was because I was hand-making all of the products myself, and I put it into jelly jars. And it was made with raw products. And I was like, okay, this is Raw in a Jar. And I just put it on with nail polish in the beginning, like on the jar. And then I added an extra A, because in Denmark, when you put two A's next to each other, it creates a letter called O. So R-O means raw in Danish. Sounds very complicated, but if you put R-double-A, it has the same meaning in Danish. That's the whole complicated story about the logo. And then Tatiana wrote, she drew the logo and she did double A and reversed the W. And then we're like, okay, it looks cool. Yeah, so it looks a lot cooler with the font. Yeah.
I'm starting a new thing the last couple of episodes where I try to leave my guests by asking them to tell me something interesting they've read recently. And it can be in print, it can be online, or something that really stayed with them. It could be a piece of news, it can be a piece of poetry. What's something interesting you read recently that stuck with you?
Well, I have something, but it's online, and it's just because I'm taking it up again. It's not really new to me, but I'm looking into making a sunscreen, and it's just a big project, and it's a lot of work. But I actually read about, and I read more about it lately, that basically sunscreen affects the ocean, like the turtles and things like that. And so I just think it's really interesting that that chemicals today can like destroy like the coral reef and all of the fish, and like that kills like all of the life in the water. It's really interesting, and just all of the chemicals in sunscreen, what it actually does. It's so crazy to me. So I'm like so motivated to make an ocean-friendly sunscreen. And that's what you call it. And it's actually a label you need to look for when you buy a sunscreen if you want to go on holiday. And I think that's so mind-blowing that it's even a thing, you know? But we just made a soap that's organic and actually super sustainable. And there's a thing with, you know, we made it exfoliating. But from this year, I believe it is, it actually is legal to put microbeads in there, which has been a big thing in the cosmetic industry, because actually the fish eats the microbeads. So that means that we actually, when we eat the fish, we get the plastic. It's super disgusting. So we made a soap with volcanic pumice just to be more sustainable and everything. So yeah, so it's possible.
I actually have two mentions on that note. On reeds, just reminded me, yeah, because I'm putting the whole Lucas feature together right now, and I'm getting a lot of help from this book called Story by Robert McGee, which is all on like script writing, but that's basically what you do when you're editing a documentary, especially where the story is not given from a pre-done script. That's helping me a lot these days. Story, and then on the lighter side, I'm reading. We're moving to LA right now. And I'm reading this book on NoFX, which is for me was a big punk band in the 90s. I like listening to and still do sometimes. This whole story is about NoFX growing up in the LA punk environment during the 80s and 90s, and it's super fun, like a really funny read, and it creates quite an interesting picture of what LA used to be like on that scene anyway. And it's fun to be in LA and have that in the back of your head, driving around.
Very cool. Well, Renee, Therese, thank you for being on Talking Paper.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You can find out more about Therese's company, Raw in a Jar, at rawinajar.com. And remember, that's Raw with two A's. You can also see Renee's video work at directorrsj.com. That includes his video work with Lucas Graham, the band Oland, his Asphalt series, his still photography, and much more. Talking Paper interviews like this one are part of a great Thursday lineup of shows for what is now Season 4 of Radio Free Brooklyn. So help us keep bringing those shows to you by giving to our Patreon at radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Give as much as you'd like and get great perks in return. The second part of this episode, I interviewed my neighbor Ben Pomeroy, who lives one floor down. Since November of 2015, he has hosted the radio program Swell Season on KPISS. It's a live radio show and podcast dedicated to the NYC area surf scene. A local surfer himself, Ben grew up in Manhattan. Part of his work is as a freelance food writer, and last July he happened to be in Turkey on assignment during a failed coup attempt and filed an op-ed piece about his observations. More recently, he turned his journalistic instincts to remembering another one of his travels, this one a 2001 journey to Havana, Cuba, where he encountered a pair of locals who would leave an impression that he felt compelled to eventually return to and write about. So here, for the first time, is his written recollection of that encounter.
It was a few days after I paid Arturo in cash to rent a room in his apartment did I realize my landlord was also a pimp. The revelation wasn't the first moment in which I knew I was over my head and unprepared to be traveling alone in Cuba. That awakening came immediately after clearing immigration and being pulled aside into a broom closet-sized room to be questioned by two agents with earpieces and tight bouncer shirts as they ran a razor down the lining of my guitar case. No, I'm not a drug smuggler. And do you know the song Chan Chan? I can play it. I assume they knew the Ibrahim hit popular song that was on the college radio circuit back home. They did, and released me after a brief sing-along. The trickier negotiation wasn't with the officers at the airport, but later on with myself. As I tried to make sense of the Havana I wanted to experience, and the real-life situation in which I had entrapped myself, feeling played, but being okay with it. It was March 2001. I was 22 years old, a year out of college. I had flown to Havana from Costa Rica, where I was living for 6 months on a grant to research coffee production in a rainy valley that struggled with leaf fungus. I decided to give the farmers in the valley a break from my clunky Spanish and interrogations on fungicides and fly to a city romantically lodged in my imagination since falling in love with its perfectly decaying colonial architecture and most of all the son and bolero music featured in Wim Wenders' 1999 documentary Buena Vista Social Club. I was in my authenticity at all costs chapter of life, and here I was in Havana, sitting front stage at the end of a scorching live salsa set at the dance club La Casa de Musica. It was the first time I had gone inside a club to dance while the sun was up, and now, well past sunset, resting and several mojitos in, I felt I'd finally arrived to that soft, focused cinematic dream. Me and a bunch of Cubans in a badly lit club at shift break. The best of these new companions was Marisol, a patient dance partner 8 years my senior. The check arrived and it came right to me. There was some discussion between the waiter and Arturo, of which my serviceable Spanish could not decipher. After arriving at some agreement, Arturo contributed some cash and indicated I was picking up the rest of the tab for this increasingly expanding entourage. When I objected, he was curt and annoyed. "You pay for everything here. How do you think it works?" Arturo hadn't been simply referring to the bottles of rum, the cabs, or everybody's door cover that I paid in order to keep the night going for this band of new friends. No, he was talking about something that, from his perspective, should have been understood and obvious to me, especially a young man from the U.S., that I was paying for access, to be with Cubans at clubs and restaurants. And this charming woman sitting next to me, was I paying for her? Arturo worked a few jobs and identities like so many Cubans who hustle in the mainstream and informal economies in order to earn cash. He was tall and rangy, which fit his background as a former athlete and present-day basketball coach. One of the first things I noticed as I walked into his Havana Vieja flat was a photo of him standing next to the 1992 Dream Team stars Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson. I was beyond impressed and felt like I was standing next to a star myself. I was not the only boarder at Arturo's. A very tall Dutch woman rented the room across from me. She could afford a hotel, but it was prohibited for her to spend nights with her Cuban boyfriend at a commercial establishment, so they sought accommodations privately. During the day, I wandered on the streets below the balconies and laundry lines of my new neighborhood, pulling into cafes to listen to live music, their windows open to the street, people stopping for a moment to dance a few steps, everyday joy that fortifies the cliches that drench this town. After meeting Marisol that night at La Casa de Musica, she joined me on some of these outings. We walked along the Malecón seawall, visited a museum filled with artifacts from the revolution as she fended off pushy docents and peppered the tour with a life of drilled-in historical and propagandist commentary. One afternoon, she returned to my room and we took our clothes off. Rather than the clumsy and careless rush typical of the collegiate disrobing I knew of, Marisol was careful with each piece of her clothing, and when it came to her lingerie, it was caro, expensive, she reprimanded me when I tried to help. We talked as much as we did anything physical, and she let me know she had a child in a boarding school outside town. She was proud of him. At some point, I left the room to use the bathroom. When I returned, something felt different, but this just might be my memory. After Marisol departed, I reflectively dug into the pocket of my bag where I kept my passport and cash. The passport was there, but some of the money was missing. Maybe $200, most of what I had for the balance of the trip. I sat on my bed, confused and ashamed. Was I angry at Marisol? Was it even her in the first place? Had she been discreet and dealt with her payment without the unpleasantness of asking? Was it even really gone, the money? I hadn't done an accounting in a day or so, just taking a few bills at a time. But yes, the wad was now indeed much smaller. If it was Marisol or somebody else, they made sure not to wipe me out. Arturo was downstairs the whole time Marisol and I were in my room together. I mentioned the missing money to him. Arturo said that I must have miscounted, and furthermore, Marisol was not a kind of person to do that. How would he know? That evening, my Dutch neighbor informed me that Arturo had been renting my room to a client while I'd been out during the day. I went upstairs and found a condom wrapper underneath my bed. Arturo was not around to explain. Over the past week, I'd seen older men at clubs and cafes arranging business with younger women and felt sorry for these paunchy guys having to pay for it. And on the side, Arturo had always been in the mix somehow. On one occasion, a young woman and a middle-aged German man unexpectedly joined our table at Arturo's invitation. We hit the town together as a group, and at the end of the night, I watched Arturo pay off a doorman and facilitate the couple's passage through the hotel lobby unmolested. Now back in Arturo's apartment, robbed and gamed, these pieces fell into place. I'd thought he was more a fixer, not really a trafficker, and maybe he was. What was the difference? It didn't feel right, but I never spoke up at the time. I was the guest, the American with money who wanted access to be with people, to see things their way. I remember confronting Arturo about him hot cheating my bed when I was out of the apartment. I can't remember his response. Was he contrite? Did he deny it? But I do know the Dutch woman left the next day. I had a couple days before my flight, and I had little choice but to remain with Arturo in his apartment, but with clean sheets. What more could go wrong? I called Marisol to confront her about the missing money. I just wanted some closure, not really an apology, to know she liked me, that it was not just about money. But maybe that was a naive and too greedy a distinction to ask for. Why could it not be both? Plus, I wanted her to have the money. I left a message with a family member. The next day, I went out to do some cheap sightseeing. Arturo said she came back, waited for me, and left. I departed for the airport the next morning. On the flight home, I listened to a recording Marisol and I did along the Malecón. Waves crash in the background. Those tapes are long gone, but I remember we sounded happy.
Thank you, Ben, for sharing that. Let's talk about that piece. It's an event 15 years gone, but why and when did you decide to write it down?
It's a story I've been thinking about since that week, and I think my first attempt to put it down was like 10 years ago, actually, and I think it was entitled My Week with the Olympian. And why I titled a kind of working draft of that, which I later abandoned or put on the shelf for a while, was for a long time, I remembered Arturo to be a member of the Cuban men's Olympic basketball team. And I did research to kind of go back and study the facts that I knew of because I didn't really have a lot of notes I was taking at the time. It was more of a vacation, but obviously I was there to learn. So I didn't have all the like exact details written down, just these kind of very strong, vivid, and kind of blunt memories. Turns out the Cuban men's basketball team never made it to the Olympics in Barcelona. They were demolished early on against the 1992 Dream Team, which any basketball fan needs to go and look up and check out the lineup. There's possibly no better lineup of players in like basketball history. I mean, I just mentioned two of the top guys. Every giant of the 90s, of kind of a golden era of basketball, was on this team. So the Cuban team that made it was the women's Cuban basketball team. Now, I went to the library on 42nd Street and went and found Granma in their files, which is, it's a state newspaper in Cuba. Now, why did I have to go to the library and go to a microfiche to look it up? Because finding records about Cuban society on the internet is so hard, at least from historical data. So I wanted to kind of double check this because in my mind, in some ways, this story is a bit about memory and a bit about how we frame experience in a way that wants to confirm how we lead our lives, how we think of things, how we wanted things to be. What I wrote and read here is as accurate a remembrance as I have. there's more details. There's more to this story, for sure. But I tried to stay with what I could really remember to have taken place.
And obviously, during the time you were down there, you mentioned at the end of the story that you had made recordings, audio recordings on the beach, now lost. Casting your mind back, were you thinking toward posterity?
Totally. I mean, I've always been a journalist to some level. I was in Costa Rica at that time. This was only about 7 or 8 days, this experience. And then I returned to this research grant I was working on, which was me hiking in a very different Latin American society, Costa Rica, a agricultural community, small farming culture, family-owned coffee farms. I would get on a bus. I would go farm to farm, hopping on and off this bus, talking to these productores, these men of the earth who had worked their farm, their grandfather worked their farm, strong connection to the land. And I would ask them questions about their plants and like the pesticides they use and a bit about their economy. But I was creating a survey to deliver to a school that had paid for my grant and a government agency that wanted to know why this community was either shifting towards organic production, how it dealt with this rust, this fungus. It was a scientific ethnology. So I was already in that, more cultural anthropology, but I was already in that way of thinking when I showed up in Cuba. So I was thinking about recording. And I was taking notes. I don't know where they are. Now, I want to pause and say that I've changed the names of the two protagonists. This is like an interesting thing for me. And I kind of made a call later on to do that. There's kind of a desire to want to protect these people. Maybe this story, this recording, what I've written will make it to Cuba. Will the authorities have some connection with it? Who knows? But it's more that it's so complicated in Cuba, and this is 16 years later. Arturo and many people I met worked in these dual economies, doing the state-appointed job and then several different hustles on the side. I mean, I didn't add the fact that Arturo had like a black market electronics business that would go down to the living room and there'd be like stereos there, and then they wouldn't be there. And like stuff that I just didn't understand. And I think that was like the crazy thing. It wasn't so like obvious that what people did. It was so integrated into what you saw that it was like side by side but masked at the same time. And I think in terms of the sex trade, that really caught me off guard, especially as like a young guy. I went to Cuba alone. I did zero preparation for it. I didn't join a group. And I was hanging out. I was hitting the clubs. Like I wanted to be in the mix. I wasn't doing a kind of sanitized, state-led or tourist-driven path around town. I was hanging out with locals, wanting them to take me to places. I ran in with a certain crowd, obviously, and I don't want to paint a picture of Havana to be filled with like operators and hustlers. But at that time, at least, it was hard to survive on the salaries that could be made from your just standard job that you receive by way of your degree or way of the state appointment. You had to have side gigs. It was one thing to say meet the cab driver who was like a doctor. I mean, that's like a famous thing, but that's for real. They would make more money in the tourism business than practicing medicine. But it was to meet the school teacher at the club who had a master's degree and then propositioned you for sex for money in a way that changed things for me, in a way that I like politely begged off. It was just such a shift from probably the very misunderstood of what brings people into the sex trade from my experience. Like I grew up in Manhattan and I would go down the West Side Highway and see girls and like outside the Lincoln Tunnel. And that was my sense of what a real life prostitute was, you know, that wasn't in the movies. Like I didn't have any, you know, like one-on-one encounters. And then I met young women who had, you know, advanced degrees and like you'd hang out with them. And then eventually this question would come up. it was something I had to really grapple with. I mean, I think what I bring into this story is that at some point I understood my role as a visiting American with cash, and that they would not have the opportunity to say, go out and dance and go to these clubs or have a meal that I would want to have unless I was paying for it. And like, I came around to that, and I understood that agreement. The experience with Marisol, again, that's not her name, but I thought that came to be kind of this interesting puzzle that I've always wrestled with, because it may not have been her that took the money. She never asked for anything explicit. It was always understood I would pay for like a drink or the sandwich. You know, like that made sense. I would be doing that anyway on a date. But she also made it clear that it was a challenge to be a Cuban, and her needs were very real. So if she indeed took that money, and the thing about it was not all my money was taken. It was a very deliberate tithing, so to speak. And so I don't know. I'm still to this day, I kind of like leave that one open. But I presented it. I wanted to present the story as I experienced it and how complicated it was, the hot cheating, my term of using my room. I thought, I mean, that was totally unacceptable. I'd paid for the room. There's a sense of trust. It's also just beyond the pale.
And for those who don't know what hot cheating is, what is hot cheating?
Well, I think maybe I heard this about a hotel thing, but it seems to be a good term for essentially like renting a room by the hour. You've heard of hot desking. That's a term that I think might be a transfer word. But instead of like renting a room for the night, you're renting it by the hour. And maybe, you know, 15-minute intervals. But, you know, here I am, this like naive guy, or rather open-minded and willing to want to trust, and already in love with this place and sympathetic to a very tough situation that Cubans were living and surviving under, to be faced with behavior and choices and an economy that didn't feel right to me, that felt unfair to them, to the women who felt that they needed to sell their bodies to visiting, you know, to tourists. It was an educational thing for me to go and see a place that I romanticized and then pulled back and saw the harsh realities, but then be a part, not just as like a witness or an academic, but like engaged in participating in it and in a way enabling it, because I was renting this room. I was kind of stuck there. I didn't have enough money to kind of jump ship. Hotels were really expensive. I was already there. Maybe I was a little lazy. So I was somewhat like acquiesced to this arrangement. And again, I really don't remember how I left it with him.
So for characters like Arturo, Marisol, and yourself, this particular corner of time that can't be repeated, even in the last couple of months, the death of Fidel Castro, the changing overtly of the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba. A few episodes ago on Talking Paper, I interviewed Lalit Marcus from Condé Nast Traveler, who was on and wrote about the first direct cruise from U.S. to Cuba this past year. Many more Americans are going to have interactions with Cubans now in a different dynamic, one would suppose, than 15 years ago when you were there. Did you feel, with all of that being, with that change happening, even in the last week or so, the change of, I believe they call it, wet foot, dry foot policy, was there an urgency for you to capture or return to this story before you forgot it? And because it was part of a time and a dynamic and a place that is gone now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if it's gone. I haven't been there. I imagine some of those structural economic pieces are still in place. As soon as that announcement came that there was going to be a warming of relations back now 2 years ago, I think it was December of maybe 14, I went back to the story as soon as I could. I mean, I thought about reformatting it. I mean, it just felt more urgent. Not simply, okay, it's timely. It's like there's an appetite or a platform. But it felt like that I wanted this bit of my life, this experience, I wanted to tell it because Americans are going to be going there. There's going to be lots of different perceptions and narratives jumping about, you know, what's modern Cuba? You know, is this a island of oppressed people? Is it an opportunity waiting to be had? Is it adventure tourism? And Cuba's a special place that is so loaded and kind of fixed in our imaginations as Americans since the blockade, especially since the embargo and since Castro, compared to other nations within our hemisphere. We have this special relationship. You know, you have folks who are deeply romantic and sympathetic of the revolution, and Fidel's passing is a loss to a certain era of politics and resistance. And then you have on the extreme end, perhaps, you know, Cuban Americans who see the end of a true tyrant and the beginning of a way to return, or the beginning of the Cuban, a rebirth of Cuba. I mean, it's so extreme. You know, I'm very upfront. Like, I love the music. I stayed with Arturo rather than it was, hotels were too expensive and I wanted to stay with a local anyway, but I was committed to putting my dollars towards directly into a Cuban's hand rather than into a European chain hotel or a state-run hotel. Like, that was a commitment of mine. So I was already on board. Now, let's even get into the fact that I traveled there legally. I got a visa in San Jose at a like college tourism shop where you could go buy like a tour package. They were offering me all this stuff, these like smiling beach scenes and like folklorica and all this stuff that you could do in Cuba. And I was like, yeah, just give me the visa, I'll handle the rest. I flew illegally. And I mean, there's a whole story we could talk about. You know, I mentioned being interrogated upon arrival. I mean, that was scary. They punched my, you know, they stamped my passport with a stamp. It said bank on it, funny enough, but nothing that indicated Cuba. And that was like the one thing you're told is don't get your passport stamped as you enter. So yeah, there was all that. I think, you know, perhaps I was even more energized or felt liberated to tell the story after this thawing, or that the kind of possibility of recrimination about breaking the embargo. I mean, do I really think that I would be tracked down? I wasn't doing trade. But people that had gone to Cuba had been on visas, and I really didn't have a formal U.S. visa.
Last question. Let's talk about journalism as an in for telling this story. You mentioned that was your take on this recounting. I've talked to people who are really into Cuban authors who left Cuba. A great movie version of a book is Before Night Falls, which I really enjoyed. My friend Chris Campagnoni is, apart from his own Cuban heritage, I believe through his father, is a teacher who teaches the books of authors, Cuban authors, who stayed in Cuba and published while there. However, there is a third branch of tales, which is the outsider's tale of any country. In your opinion, Ben, what's the importance of having a journalistic style observation of another country from someone who's neither a native or an expatriate?
That gets into this interesting role of you're not bringing a ton of bias to a scene or a location. You're coming in as a outsider. That can give you a freedom to kind of see things without a lot of prior experience or influence by way of family, influence by way of history or heritage. There's an opportunity there to be a matter of fact, somewhat dispassionate. There's an opportunity for that. I think there's also an incredible risk of being the kind of like this exoticizing, the coming in as the outsider and doing a rather surface examination, appreciation, and departure just like that from a place, and doing the people a disservice in your tale, and just that, a tale, this sense of like classic tradition of the almost the armchair anthropologist or the colonial, seeing people not as humans operating in their environment and communities, but as this other, and that would be seeing them as a place apart, not contemporary. So I think there's a long history of traps and pitfalls for the outsider tourist anthropologist. I think I tried to couch my romantic flair with an acknowledgement of some of the preset cliches of Havana. This is straight up a personal tale spoken from 16 years out in an attempt to be as kind of close to what I remember as possible. And acknowledging that like memory changes and at the time of youth, things are, you're very impressionable. And so it was a very heavy time and a very kind of very spongy moment of my imagination experience for good reason. I took the risk that I did. I had the threw caution to the wind. But if I went back as an adult, I think I would see things differently. Would I be in those situations? Maybe not. And that might be too bad. You know, I think there's something about youthful indiscretion that allows us to get into these situations and learn and hopefully come back and tell that tale appropriately and respectfully.
Ben Pomeroy, thank you for sharing your personal tale of Cuba on Talking Paper.
Thank you so much, Christian. This is fun.
You can read more of Ben's work and listen to episodes of Swell Season at benpomeroy.contently.com. A final note about the literary side of Cuba. This is the opening paragraph of Chris Campagnoni's review in the Brooklyn Rail of Pablo Medina's 2015 poetry collection, The Island Kingdom, from Hanging Loose Press. The history of Cuba is a history of exile, from the eradication of the indigenous Neo-Taino and Guanahatabey population in the 1500s, to the forced departure of nonconformists by the Castro government in the second half of the 20th century. To be Cuban, José Lezama Lima once said, is to already feel foreign. But to be Cuban is also to be manifold, as José Martí proclaimed in his celebrated poem, Yo soy un hombre sincero. I come from everywhere, and I am going toward everywhere. To be Cuban is to be inherently a synthesis, a body comprised of various parts. And so Cuba's rich literary history is filled with writers like Guillermo Cabreba Infante, Severo Sardui, and Nicolas Guillén, linguists for which language is a banquet, a feast of words where everything goes through the mouth, sea comio, and comes out in an essay before it converges back upon itself, each part reinforced and refashioned, elongated and expanded, to create a utopia that has no location but the location of the text, the possibility of excess and the excess of possibilities. If you want to listen to past episodes of Talking Paper, check out our podcasts at audioboom.com/channel/Talking Paper. That's all for this episode of Talking Paper. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.